hear what it says in the papers, is Deirdre Purcell.
Schools and schoolchildren, maths, carers, cuts, violent crime, and of course the travails of John McGuinness, all in your newspapers this morning. The Irish Examiner lead story is based on that survey of 10-year-olds and shows, according to Stephen Rogers and Niall Murray, that in two-thirds of Irish primary schools, teachers are struggling to teach pupils who are too sleepy and are too hungry to concentrate. Inside, Caroline O'Doherty is reporting on yesterday's protest by carers. She quotes Joanne Powell, mother of a 29-year-old disabled daughter, who said that as a result of cuts to her daughter's transport to a daycare centre, she may have to put her in residential care. In this case, the diminution, she says, will save €5,300 per year, while full-time residential care will cost the HSE an annual €52,000. The Irish Times leads with Carl O'Brien's story about cuts in funding for a training and advice service for childminders. This, we're told, is despite recent pledges to increase standards in childcare. The HSE has said the cuts are due to pressure on HSE resources and the need to prioritise funding in other areas of frontline services. The Irish Daily Star leads with the courtroom heartbreak of the husband of Jill Maher, whose murder in Australia has led to a conviction. And the words of Ms. Maher's father supply one of the three pieces on the front pages of the Irish Independent, where George McKeown turned directly to the killer and said simply, "It is not okay to rape and kill my child." The second Independent piece is comment, again about school matters, by Sean Close, suggesting that the way maths is taught in primary school could be at the root of Ireland's below average international standing in maths in secondary school. The third is again about the controversy surrounding the chairman of the Public Accounts Committee, John McGuinness. And the Times' Harry McGee acknowledges that while the questions Mr. McGuinness faces are embarrassing, he wonders in print if they actually render the TD's position as chairman of PAC untenable, and answers himself thus, the short answer is no. The Irish Daily Mirror's lead concerns the stabbing to death of 23-year-old Dean Fitzpatrick, sister of the missing Amy Fitzpatrick. Mr. Fitzpatrick's partner, Sarah O'Rourke, is expected to talk to Gordy today about threats made to him before his death, including a menacing phone call she herself received. Sean Quinn Jr. was in court again yesterday, and in a bid finally to purge his contempt of court orders, with his wife's consent, he is to sell his Dublin home, valued at about €400,000, and described as his only owned asset. In the Times, Irish Independent and Irish Examiner, we're told that while Ms. Justice Elizabeth Dunn accepted that Mr. Quinn was making efforts to purge his contempt, she rejected as inadequate his alternative offer of a $75,000 payment. The court will be updated in October on progress of the house sale, and in the Independent and Times, the judge is quoted as saying she didn't want to keep Mr. Quinn before the court forever, and meaning it in the nicest possible way, would be delighted to see the back of him. And finally for now, amidst all the talk about school children and exams, today is World Day Against Child Labour. Every day, we're told, millions of children leave home early in the morning, not for school, but for work. The Times runs a full-page piece from Lima, Peru, highlighting in words and pictures the plight of several families, including that of Juan Huachacha, aged 10, who gets up at 3 a.m. and whose job is to make bricks alongside his father in order to keep the family in food. The pay is €10 per day should they produce their target of 1,000 bricks. If they don't hit that target, they don't get paid. So everyone in the family has to help, even the smallest children, aged 3 and 5.
11 minutes past 7, very nearly. It's time for early business news from Emma McNamara.
Thanks, Cathal. In a letter in today's Financial Times, Jack Schuler, a former board member of Elan, questions the experience and competence of the company's management and claims its proposed transactions are value destructive. In the letter, Mr. Schuler, who's also the former president of Abbott, said that in his view, Elan's board and management has very limited experience in doing deals and that he believes it's not competent to run a business. He said he has no confidence confidence that Kelly Martin, the chief executive, or the other Elan board members will act in the interests of shareholders. This comes as Royalty Pharma has accused Elan of misleading shareholders over voting procedures crucial to its $6.7 billion hostile bid for the company, ahead of a deadline today to approve a series of alternative transactions by Elan. The US-based private equity company claims Elan has misinformed holders of its American depository shares of the deadline by which they would need to register in order to vote for a series of transactions that would undermine Royalty's bid. Elan has rejected Royalty's bid as wholly inadequate and hinted at alternative bidders by saying it had instructed its advisors to examine several unsolicited corporate inquiries. And EU democracy has gone to the dogs. That's according to critics of European Central Bank policy, which could see the bank buying sovereign bonds through a programme called Outright Monetary Transactions, or OMT. Germany's Constitutional Court today sits for a second day to assess whether the policy set up to calm the bond markets is contrary to German law. While OMT is yet to be used, it reassured investors that they would not lose their money and reduce the cost of borrowing for countries like Spain and Portugal. And at 10 to 8, we'll be joined by the German ambassador to Ireland, Dr. Eckhard Lubkemeyer, on this. And cloud computing firm Citrix says it's increasing its Dublin workforce by up to 50 employees. The roles are in technical support, sales, IT operations and online services, covering its Europe, Middle East and Africa region. And on the currency markets this morning, the euro is trading at $1.32.97 and 85 pence sterling.
Morning, Ireland. It's 14 minutes past 7. To Turkey now, where riot police clashed with protesters overnight after using tear gas and water cannons to clear thousands of people from Taksim Square in the commercial centre of Istanbul. The authorities say police will work day and night to end the protests against what's claimed to be the increasingly authoritarian rule of Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan, and which have been now ongoing across the country for 13 days. Journalist David O'Byrne was there as the square was cleared. David, good morning. What happened?
Good morning. Well, I just arrived in the square when, I was on the south side of the square. There was a lot of people there. The people were still arriving in the square to protest against the government plans to destroy the park on the north side. There had been clashes in the morning between police and some fringe political groups. There was no sort of untoward behaviour where I was. People were not shouting slogans. They weren't doing anything. They were simply standing around. And suddenly we were bombarded with tear gas. People started running from one side of the square where the police were to the other side of the square. And suddenly on that side of the square there was tear gas as well. So you had tens of thousands of people running from tear gas into tear gas. It was complete and utter mayhem.
Was there any warning, David?
No warning whatsoever.
Right now, is Taksim Square cleared? Or more to the point, are there still ongoing protests? Because what we've heard being reported is that is police using bulldozers to try and remove some of the protest debris from Taksim Square, but people simply moving somewhere else.
That, as far as I understand, that's what's happening. It's a little bit difficult to, without actually going up there again, it's a little bit difficult to see exactly what's happening because the mainstream media in Turkey is still not reporting fully what's going on. My understanding is that there are still protesters in the park. That's the park which is planned to be destroyed, but there's nobody left in the square itself.
Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan said that he will now talk with demonstrators, but he seems to be singling out those who were originally protesting against the renovation of a park in the city and not those who now seem to regard the protest as one against his rule.
That seems to be what he's claiming. It's a little bit difficult to understand exactly who he wants to talk to because there was never an organised protest against the destruction of the park. And it's not a renovation, by the way, it's destruction. They're going to completely flatten it and build a shopping centre. Although subsequently they claim they don't plan to build a shopping centre. It's a little bit difficult to understand who exactly he's going to talk to. As I said, there was no organised protest. It was a small group of people who independently occupied the park, put up tents and protested against the destruction of the park. Since then, what's happened is that people from all over Istanbul, in fact all over Turkey, have congregated on the park and on the square to protest against this. There's no group organising the protests. There's no group which is coordinating them. It's a completely grassroots protest. So who he thinks he's going to negotiate with, I really don't understand.
And yet he said he will not tolerate any more protests. It was a very hard-line speech he delivered to Parliament yesterday. He got a huge round of applause for doing so. Is it fair to say that he has the majority of people in Turkey behind his position?
Well, he wasn't addressing Parliament. He was addressing his parliamentary group.
My apologies, yes.
The party he was speaking to. So it's not exactly surprising that he got a round of applause. Well, he's repeatedly stated that he got 50% of the vote in the last election and he can do exactly what he wants. Now, that is true up to a point. He did receive 50% of the vote, but under the Turkish electoral system, parties which receive less than 10%, the votes that go to those parties are distributed amongst the other parties, those that get over 10%. And in fact, the governing Justice and Development Party only got 38% of the vote in the last election, which is not a majority.
David,
I think it would be fair to say that he doesn't have the majority of the Turkish people behind him, certainly not on those results.
David, I know that when this all started, you said that you were amongst many who were taken by surprise by the speed of these protests and by how they had grown up so quickly. Do you expect people to be put off by what's happened over the last day or two, or do you expect the reverse to be true, that more and more people are now going to get out onto the streets and protest?
Well, people, you're right, yeah, we were taken by surprise, and continue to be so. I don't see anything happening which is liable to placate the anger which people are feeling at what's happening. The reason people decided to protest in the first place was because they were angry both with the heavy-handed attitude of the government in regard to this park, and also their heavy-handed attitude towards several other issues, such as demolishing and replacing a cultural centre, which is on the one side of Taksim Square, and the heavy-handed policing, which has been used to try and suppress protest. And I really don't see anything that has happened which will stop people from feeling anger at what's going on.
David O'Byrne in Istanbul, thank you.
The Cabinet meets later this morning with just one item on the agenda, the drafting of the Protection of Life in Pregnancy Bill. We're joined by our political correspondent, David McCullough. First, David, let's listen to some of what Health Minister James Reilly had to say about this on primetime last night.
The legislation is to clarify the situation for the people who must provide the service and for the women who need the service. And can I make the point? I think it's a very important point to make, that if a woman's life is in danger and you don't protect that life, you're going to lose both the life of the mother and the child. So I think this is a very reasonable thing to do, to protect the lives of women, to give clarity to the medical profession.
Are you actually
and the life of the
echoing,
unborn, where at all possible.
And that's James Reilly talking to Pat Kenny last night. David, a very reasonable thing to do is what James Reilly is describing the bill as, but is there a problem in drafting a reasonable form of this that's acceptable to both Fine Gael and Labour? I'm afraid we're having difficulty with David McCullough, but what we'll probably do is, unless we can get him up in the next couple of seconds...
Hello, Cathal. Hello.
David, how are you? The issue of, how big a problem is there, do you think?
Well, it's not quite clear how big a problem there is. There clearly is a problem of some description. Now, it does seem that it's a question of drafting rather than a question of anything more serious. We've been told by both parties in government very vociferously that political agreement was reached on Monday night between James Reilly and Alex White, who represented the two parties, so they know what's going to be in the bill. It's just a question of coming up with the correct legal form of wording to go into a piece of legislation. As you know, great pains are taken with the wording of legislation or draft legislation to try and make it as watertight as possible. And this is the suggestion that was being given by spokesmen for both parties in government yesterday, that was what was going on. But clearly there has been some change since the draft heads of the bill were published some months ago. It appears that change relates to this question of a review clause of some description, that there would be a built-in method whereby a report would be made back to either to government or more likely to the Oireachtas to explain how this legislation is working in practice, how many procedures are carried out under it and so on. Now, you'll remember some months ago that there, the Week in Politics revealed that there had been lobbying by a number of Fine Gael backbenchers looking for a sunset clause, which is a slightly different thing. That would be a clause which would say that the bill, the legislation, would cease to be effective by a certain date unless it was renewed. And we have that, for instance, with the Offences Against the State Act and things like that. They have to come up for renewal every year. That's what Fine Gael backbenchers were looking for. That doesn't seem to be on the cards. Certainly Labour weren't disposed to take that on board, but they didn't seem to have a problem with a review clause. So that seems to be where it's at. Now, if, as we're told, political agreement was reached on Monday night, then it should merely be a question of getting the wording right. And there seemed to be some confidence this morning that that wording would be correct and would be ready for Cabinet when it meets in just under an hour's time.
And do you detect any kind of wavering or any kind of pressure having an effect, given the intensive lobbying we've seen from this big rally against the bill on Saturday and the Catholic Bishop's statement yesterday?
Well, I think if there could be changes that would be helpful from Fine Gael's point of view, they'd be very happy to take them and they'd be very anxious to take them. But at least in public, the Taoiseach and the Minister for Health remain wedded to the idea of bringing this legislation through. They haven't been quite as forthright in their response to the Catholic bishops yesterday as Labour Party spokespersons were. But they have insisted that this legislation needs to go through. They have insisted that the government is required to legislate for the X case, despite the fact that the bishops disagreed with that. And they are wedded to a course of action. Now, the interesting question, I think, is how many TDs and senators will they lose overboard in the process? They'll certainly lose some. Peter Matthews has said repeatedly that he will vote against the legislation, and it seems highly unlikely that he'll be alone. There's certainly a couple of senators who are likely to join him in breaking the party whip. And despite the fact that the bishops have called for a free vote for freedom of conscience of legislators in this regard, the Taoiseach is insisting that there will be no free vote and that if anybody votes against the party line, there will be consequences, political consequences for them.
We can't let you go, David, without dealing with this, let's put it this way, strong language used in the Shannon yesterday by Fianna Fáil Senator Mark McSharry. It's getting a lot of attention, all of it critical, it has to be said. Let's listen to some of what the Senator had to say about the Taoiseach.
We see him clowning around Europe, as it has to be said, acting like a clown, turning a circus ring of government and indeed the office.
I object.
I have a question for the leader.
I object to that kind of language in relation to the T-shirt.
And so it went on. You heard the voice there of Senator Marie-Louise O'Donnell, Taoiseach's nominee, objecting there. A little later on, Senator McSharry turned his fire on the Cathaoirleach of the Shannon, Paddy Burke, because...
Particularly yourself, Cathaoirleach, frankly, the closest confidant of the Taoiseach, and you've allowed him, your name in this House, and his politics over the years.
McSherry, you're completely out of order.
I am completely in order. And you should be showing leadership as the leader in this House, standing up for his contribution over the years.
Senator, you showed no respect to the House here this morning.
And in case you didn't believe your ears, yes, he did talk about urinating on the House. Not one of the finer moments of Shannon debating. David, its effect?
Well, I suppose defenders of the Shannon often talk about the better standard of debate you get in the upper house. If that was an example of it, I'm not sure how effective it'll be in helping to preserve the Shannon or helping to improve its reputation. It should be said that Senator McSharry has form in this area. He earlier in the year compared the government to Ceausescu in its plans to get rid of the Shannon. So I suppose overblown rhetoric is not something that is all that rare in politics, but I think that probably takes the biscuit. And whether it makes people more likely to preserve the Shannon or not remains to be seen.
David, thank you very much. 7:26.
Let's hear more about that report now from Women's Aid on the abuse suffered by women and children in their own homes over the past year at the hands of their partner, father or stepfather. and in particular a huge increase in the abuse of children being reported to them. Women's Aid provides help to women who say they're being abused at home. Their director is Margaret Martin and she's with us now. Margaret, thank you for coming in to us. 3,230 disclosures of child abuse to you last year. What sort of abuse and why are your members being told this in such increasing numbers, do you think?
Well, the type of abuse would primarily be emotional abuse, where children are being shouted at, being called abusive names, sometimes, in fact, even being urinated on, being threatened very often, seeing their pets being abused and seeing their mother being abused. So emotional abuse would be huge. Children would also be very often physically and sexually abused, but that would not be, those figures would not be as large. I think part of the reason we're hearing a higher level of disclosures in terms of direct abuse is what we saw last year was women talking more about children being in the home, and with the focus with Children's First and all the talk about child abuse, I think that's creating a space for women to be able to talk more about what's happening to them but also what's happening to their children, and to talk about the difficulties they face even when they have left their partners. About half of the women that we would see would have separated from their partners, have left the relationship sometimes for a couple of years, but the abuse unfortunately continues, and it continues particularly during access visits. And one of the things that we're really pushing for is that any arrangements that are made about any structures, the safety of the children and their mother needs to be prioritised over contact.
I'll come back to what you're looking for there in relation to legislative changes or otherwise. What do your members do when they're told these allegations of child abuse?
Well, a lot of the disclosures would be directly to the helpline. Some of them would be anonymous. They would be encouraged themselves to contact a social worker. If they're women we were working with, very often they're already working with social workers.
Are you obliged to contact social workers or authorities when you receive those allegations?
We would work with women. A lot of the time what we would be doing is we're working with women who are already working with social workers where they would disclose child abuse. We would encourage them to do so, but if they don't do so, we would do so, because what we find is it's far more effective if a woman is involved and does it herself and supports, that the outcomes are much better. But we would certainly always notify people, but a lot of the work that we would do, there would be social workers involved already.
I know you're calling for court sittings, as exist in some other countries, for cases like this to be made available on a 24/7 basis, but tell me about some of the changes that you want in relation to the law, and particularly access to children from spouses or partners who allegations have been made against of abuse.
Well, there's a number of things. We know that the domestic violence legislation is being reviewed. We know that the whole operation of the family law courts has been reviewed. And essentially what we're saying is we have 40 years of experience of dealing with domestic violence. Domestic violence is the most common context for child abuse. And that the voice of the child needs to be, I mean, we're not alone in saying this, needs to be taken into account. So when there's custody and access arrangements that are being put into place, the voice of the child needs to be heard in relation to that. Children, sometimes when they're coming to the end of their primary years or the early secondary school years, they're well able to talk about what they want themselves and how they feel. There are children that their mothers are reporting to us that they're self-harming, they're wet in the bed, they're having nightmares before they go on access visits. So safety needs to be addressed. We're not against contact, and very often women will be very keen to provide ongoing relationships with the children's fathers and will do their utmost to provide that. But it has to be in a safe context.
Margaret Martin, Director of Women's Aid, thank you for coming into us this morning. 25 to 8, you're listening to Morning Ireland. Darren Frehett is here with the sports news, because while most of you were sleeping, Ireland were being beaten by the world champions in New York.
Yeah, not as bad as it was 12 months ago, though. I'm glad to say, Gavin, 2-0 last night we lost to the Spanish team in the Yankee Stadium in America. The Irish kept the world and European champions at bay for 69 minutes, but goals by Soldado and Mata secured the win. Declan O'Kelly sent us this report from New York.
A crowd of 39,368 turned up to see the two teams in action, but it was Spain who retained most of the possession. Ireland had their chances, most notably in the 27th minute, when Conor Salmon robbed a careless PK of possession and bore down on goal, but his side-footed effort was well wide and did not trouble Valdez. Spain came close to scoring in the 19th minute when McCarthy cleared a PK header off the line, and in the 41st minute, Silva played a through ball to Pedro, who rattled the crossbar with Ford well beaten. In the 69th minute, the Spanish got the breakthrough when Arbeloa juggled the ball on the edge of the box. It fell to Soldado, who volleyed into the bottom left-hand corner of the net. In the 88th minute, a great ball from Salmon put James McLean through on goal, but his shot was turned over the bar by Casillas. The resulting corner saw a Stephen Kelly header pushed onto the bar brilliantly by the Real Madrid keeper. The ensuing scramble resulted in St. Ledger sliding in to score, but the goal was disallowed because Simon Cox was ruled offside correctly. However, Spanish class told in the 88th minute when a wonderful series of passes saw Carzola put Mata through, and the Chelsea man was able to slip the ball past Randolph into the Irish net. The game ended 2-0, and though the Irish lost, the nature of this defeat was quite different to that of 1 year ago in Poznan.
Now, Sweden have moved ahead of Ireland on goal difference in Group C of the World Cup qualifiers following a 2-0 win against the Faroe Islands last night. Zlatan Ibrahimovic got both goals. And just to look at the table now, second place Austria, third place Sweden and fourth place Ireland are all level on 11 points each. But the goal difference is really important here. Austria's goal difference plus 10. The Swedes are plus 4 and the Irish plus 2. So,
and we've played the Faroes twice already.
We have. Look, it's going to be down to those two games, isn't it, in September when we play Sweden and Austria. So I think our hopes of qualifying will come down to those that week in September, I think it is. Longford Town player Colm James has been banned from all football-related activities for 18 months. He's been found guilty on 6 counts for breaching FAI rules associated with match integrity. Now, these rules centre on bringing the game into disrepute, corruption and gambling. The player has the right to appeal. There are more reports this morning that Luis Suarez will leave Liverpool this summer. The attacker is on international duty with Uruguay and he has, it seems, indicated he'd like to sign for Real Madrid. A late goal by Marty Kavanagh earned Carlow's hurlers a 2-point victory over Dublin in the Bord Gáis Energy Under-21 Championship last night. It finished Carlow 1-13, Dublin 1-11 at Parnell Park. Carlow will now play Wexford in the Leinster semi-finals. Cavan football manager Terry Hyland has named an unchanged team for this Sunday's quarter-final, Ulster quarter-final against Fermanagh. In rugby, members of the Irish rugby squad touring North America have been hit by a stomach bug. A number of the squad are in isolation. Good news, though, from Toronto is that Peter O'Mahony, Chris Henry, Fergus McFadden, Robbie Henshaw, they're all making good progress from their respective injuries and they're hoping to be fit for Saturday's game with Canada. Now, the US Open gets underway on Thursday and just after the news at 8:30 this morning, we'll be hearing from Rory McIlroy. Greg Allen has been talking to him in Pennsylvania. The world number two admits he's been struggling with his game of late but believes he needs just one good round to turn things around. He's also a big fan of the course in Merion.
I like it. They've changed a few things, from how the members play it, like moved fairways, closer to out of bounds, I suppose, and closer to roads, and they've made it visually a little different. But I like it. It's a traditional old style golf course. I've always tended to favour those sort of golf courses over in the States, and as long as you put your ball in the fairway here, you're going to have chances.
And more from Rory in just under an hour's time. In cycling, Dan Martin remains 7th in the overall standings in the Tour of Switzerland, while Nicholas Roach is 20th ahead of Stage 5 today. Finally, there's racing this evening at Ferry House. The action gets underway at 6 o'clock.
The video rental chain Extravision has been sold to Hilco Capital Ireland for a sum which has not been disclosed. Hilco, which recently bought HMV in Ireland and in Britain, will now take control of the chain's business, stock and head office in Talla in Dublin. Extravision employs between north and south about 1,000 people. So what's the future for them and for the business? Now, joining us, our business editor, David Murphy. First of all, the new owners. What do you know about them, David?
Well, Hilco is owned and run by a man called Paul McGowan. He's a Belfast-based accountant. He was born and raised in Belfast. He's now living in RD and he spends most of his week working from London. And he has run a company called Hilco, which is specialised in turning around distressed retailers. And he's done some very big deals in the past. He's taken over HMV in Ireland, the UK and Canada. While they're really up and running again in the UK and Canada, they're turning their attention to Ireland, where 4 of the stores will be reopened and 100 of the 300 staff will be going back to work there. Some of the original staff will be going back to work there. internationally, they're very, very big. They've been involved in Canada's largest carpet maker. They also bought and then sold the chain Habitat in the UK. And in Ireland, they've been involved in the Aware chain. So they've been involved in an awful lot of businesses, but particularly businesses which are in deep distress, which are being sold either in liquidation or in receiverships.
So for the moment, you were saying three stores definitely going to open.
In terms of what's going to happen with Extravision, they haven't specified exactly how many of the 130 stores will open. Just the exact figure is that there are 803 staff working across those stores on both sides of the border. About three quarters of the staff are in the Republic of Ireland. What they're going to do is that they will open negotiations with each of the landlords to see if they can renegotiate leases and bring down rents. And where they can, they will be reopening the stores. So I understand a small number of the stores will be closing, but at the moment it's all very vague regarding how many will remain open and how many jobs will be retained. But I guess there's a little bit of surprise that this has gone ahead, in the sense that the difficulty for Extravision was this. Many people are now downloading films, or they're streaming on the internet and watching movies via services like Netflix, or the player are watching programming on player services like RTE's. So the question is, how much business is there going to be in 5 or 10 years' time for people to rent DVDs? And I understand that the rental business had been declining very dramatically in areas around Ireland where fibre optic broadband, or the next generation of broadband, had been introduced. However, the retail business of selling soft drinks, of selling sweets, that business had been doing relatively well. So the question for Hilco is, are they going to redevelop the retail business and shrink the rental business over time to make Extravision a viable brand in future?
All right. But for the moment, the most immediate question, I suppose, is rents.
I think rents are going to be the immediate question. They've said that they have had messages of support from a number of landlords, and they say that therefore they're hopeful that they'll be able to retain all of the stores which they've agreed to acquire. But there's no guarantee of that. We don't really know. And in the case, certainly, of their acquisition with HMV, while that had closed when it was bought by Hilco, they haven't been able to reopen all of those stores. There are only four of the HMV stores which are going to be open. So we don't know exactly what's going to happen with Extravision. Obviously, the staff will have their fingers crossed, and there were some positive messages from the staff on the internet last night, but we'll have to see what happens.
Indeed. And as you said, 800 jobs on the island of Ireland, we'll see. Not 1,000, as I was saying. 800 jobs, we'll see what the future is in the days and weeks to come. David Murphy, thank you. It's 7:45.
A landmark immigration bill passed a crucial test in the US Senate yesterday that could pave the way for thousands of illegal Irish immigrants there to eventually become US citizens. The US Senate voted to advance the immigration bill for floor debate. Our reporter Petula Martin spoke to David Nakamura, the White House correspondent with the Washington Post, and began by asking him what's in this bill.
The bill has a number of important components, and I think probably the biggest feature in the bill is that it would eventually give a path to legal status for about 11 million undocumented immigrants are here in the country illegally. And that's obviously been a long-time goal of immigration advocates who worry that these folks are here illegally, so they're kept in the shadows, they don't pay taxes, they're being hired perhaps by employers improperly, and they're living sort of secret lives. And so that's the most important path. It would take 10 years to gain full legal status and green cards, and then another 3 years, 13 years total, for a path to citizenship. And to sort of appease other folks on the other side of the debate who are concerned about that, the bill also features a heavy investment in additional border security along the U.S.-Mexico border, about $7 billion in over a decade to increase fencing and drones, flying unmanned drones along the border to catch people coming over, more customs agents. That's the other big piece. And finally, the third big component is new work visa programs to add a number of high-tech workers who come from other countries, and then also low-skilled immigrants who are here for sort of lower-skilled jobs that employers say Americans don't want to do. So those are the three main components. each is controversial for their own reasons, and each faces a difficult path through amendment process to come.
Now, Republicans have begun to mount a forceful opposition to the legislation. Why? Is it not in their interest to win over the Latino vote in particular?
It is, and I think a number of Republican leaders, especially among the establishment in the House, in the Senate, think that this is very important. President Obama won more than 70% of the Latino and Asian vote. Largely, he appealed to these communities a number of reasons, but immigration, fixing the immigration system, giving a path to citizenship for these undocumented immigrants was a big reason that these folks supported President Obama. And Republicans recognize that, and with the growing number of these immigrant groups here in the country among Latinos and Asians, I think Republicans are saying, look, if we want to ever win the White House back, it's going to be important to tap into this community. They're upset about the broken immigration system. We got to do something. So Republican leaders understand that the problem is the Republican Party is very splintered. There's sort of an ideological war going on inside the party of how hard to sort of hold a hard line against these illegal immigrants. A number of Republicans and their supporters out there in the country say, hey, these people are here illegally. Why should they have a chance to become legal residents when other people around the world are waiting to come legally? There's a big backlog. Why don't we try to address that? This bill tries to do both. But the Republican Party is very split. And so the very conservative Republicans are saying, we're not going to vote for a bill that allows this path to citizenship unless we're certain that there's new border security. And they want to add even more measures of border security. This alarms immigration advocates who say this is just a ruse to prevent and delay these illegal immigrants from having a chance at citizenship. And so that's what they're concerned about, and that's what you're going to hear over the next month or two as both the Senate and the House will be debating their own bills.
In a speech earlier, President Obama mentioned Ellis Island. Now, thousands upon thousands of Irish people entered the United States through Ellis Island. Do Irish immigrants hold any sway in this debate?
Yes, I'd say that, everybody holds some sway, I think. And I think that the truth is, this is a issue really being driven probably by Latino community. And I think that they're the ones who make up most of the illegal immigrants, and they're the ones who have the biggest voice in this. So I'd say that that's probably really where this is going. And I think the politics behind it is driven by the fact that Latino groups growing so quickly in the country, and they're very concerned about this.
That was David Nakamura, White House correspondent with the Washington Post, speaking to Petula Martin. Emma McNamara is back with more business news.
Thanks very much, Gavin. EU democracy has gone to the dogs. That's according to German critics of European Central Bank policy, which could see the bank buying foreign or sovereign bonds through a programme called Outright Monetary Transactions, or OMT. Germany's constitutional court today sits for a second day to assess whether the policy set up to calm the bond markets is contrary to German law. OMT was first signalled in London last July when the ECB president Mario Draghi promised to do whatever it takes to save the single currency. And while OMT has yet to be used, it has reassured investors that they would not lose their money and has reduced the cost of borrowing for countries like Spain and Portugal. Dr. Eckhard Luckmeier, the German ambassador to Ireland, joins us now in studio. Ambassador, in this case, seen as a battle of monetary policy heavyweights, where do you stand?
Well, we stand with the ECB, as the finance minister yesterday said at the court hearings, that we don't see this as violating the mandate of the ECB. What the ECB actually hasn't been doing yet, but has announced that they would do if need be, i.e. buying the bonds of sovereign states in order to stabilize the currency and to make monetary policy work. So we do not think, we the government do not think, that this is in breach of the treaty and the ECB's mandate.
Yet it throws up yet again the issue of design flaws within the Eurozone. Are cases like this helpful to bring these design flaws to light, or is it something that should be more concentrated on at the governing policy meetings of the ECB and the European Union itself, where these things can be ironed out?
Well, we don't need a court hearing, actually, to make us realize that there are design flaws. The crisis has made us realize that, yes, we need to correct certain problems that have come to the fore in the wake of the crisis, or in the course of the crisis, I should rather say. And we all realize that we have to go back to the drawing board, and that's what we have been trying to do for the past 3 years almost, For example, in terms of putting our common currency on a more firm footing when it comes to public budgets, we have, as you know, concluded a fiscal treaty that will bring more oversight and more discipline to public budgets in the future. And one of, and I should stress, one of the causes of the crisis has been excessive public debt.
You, in an Irish Times opinion piece recently, said that Germany can and should be criticised for how it's behaved during the crisis. What would these criticisms be, do you think, the main ones?
Well, that's up to our critics to do. All I was trying to point out is that criticising Germany is perfectly legitimate. We have our own point of view, but we do respect that others have other points of view. And this is perfectly legitimate in a European family. And what we need to do is have an open, a frank discussion about our differences and then come to a compromise. And that's actually how the European Union works. And that's what we have been doing for the past years.
The current and strongest criticism is about the austerity versus growth debate, and that some of the policies that Germany is encouraging for austerity in countries like Ireland, like Portugal, Greece and Spain are just too hard on the economies, and that for Germany to be strong, you need your neighbours to be strong. The austerity is killing growth in these countries, so we can't buy your things.
Well, first of all, yes, we do need strong and prosperous neighbours. We do need prosperous neighbors in Europe, because Europe will always remain our most important trading place. So there cannot be prosperity in Germany without prosperous neighbors. The issue that we are debating with some of our critics is whether austerity, as it's being called here, we would rather use the term consolidation of public and private budgets, living within your means is actually what we would say, that whether living within your means is a precondition for growth or is an impediment to growth. Our position is that living within your means is a precondition for sustainable growth, long-term sustainable growth.
You've also said that Germany holds the power of the purse. Do you think Germany holds that power well?
Yes, that's what we do, because we have shown extended solidarity to our neighbors, and we will continue to do so, because there cannot be a stable and prosperous Germany without stable and prosperous neighbors. So yes, extending solidarity to our neighbors, to our Eurozone neighbors, is in the very best German interest. That's what we have been doing, and that's what we will continue to do. And actually, what we started this interview with the hearings at the Constitutional Court. This is about German solidarity versus the ECB, and what the ECB has been doing has the implicit backing of the German economy, because without the implicit backing of a strong German economy, the ECB would never have been able to do what it has done in the past.
And is the German role in the bailout or the programs that countries in the Eurozone are going through communicated well to the German public? Because there is popular public opposition there.
There's opposition, and there's even more concern on the part of German people that perhaps we are taking on too many liabilities in the process of showing extending solidarity to our struggling Eurozone neighbors. At the same time, I should stress that all the major decisions have been taken by a broad-based majority in the German Bundestag. The government, especially the chancellor, enjoys a very high approval rating, not least because of her Eurozone policy. So yes, there is concern, but there's also a broad-based support for the kind of policy the government has been pursuing in the course of the crisis. And as you may know, we will have elections coming up in the fall and September. And I can assure you, this issue will not be at the forefront of those that will be debated in the campaign, because there still is a broad-based consensus in Germany on the basic pillars of our Eurozone policy.
But that feeds straight into the argument that Chancellor Angela Merkel has been accused of posing as extra tough at home on the rest of the Eurozone for political advantage.
Well, I mean, she has to consider, first of all, that she retains this popular support for what we have been doing, that retains the support for the solidarity that we have been extending to others. And at the same time, of course, she has to make sure that we correct the design flaws of the Eurozone and that we take the kind of measures that would ensure long-term sustainable growth. So she has to take into account these two points of view, what our partners think, what is necessary for a stabilization of the Eurozone for long-term growth, at the same time retaining domestic support for extending solidarity.
Dr. Eckhard Lunkmeier, the German ambassador to Ireland, thanks very much for joining us in studio this morning. We didn't get to the G8. We'll have to leave that for another day. For now, on the currency markets, the euro is trading at $1.32.9 and 85 pence sterling.
Weather. Joanna Donnelly, good morning.
Good morning. Well, it'll start out dry for much of the country today and some brighter sunny spells will be widespread for a time. But cloud will thicken in Munster through the morning, however, and the rain will spread into southwestern areas during the early afternoon, extending countrywide through the course of the rest of the day. It should stay dry in Ulster, however, well until evening. Highest temperatures today, 16 to 19 degrees with mainly light variable winds. Rain will continue overnight and into the early morning, although it will become more showery in nature. Some heavy bursts are likely with a possible rumble of thunder. Lowest temperatures tonight, 10 or 11 degrees, while winds will become light to moderate westerly by morning. Tomorrow, Thursday, will be a showery day with some brighter sunny spells between heavy scattered showers, especially during the early part of the day. The showers will be more isolated for time of the year, afternoon and early evening. Highest temperatures tomorrow, 14 to 17 degrees, with moderate to fresh westerly winds becoming southwesterly. Thursday night will be dry for a time, but rain in the southwest early in the night will extend to all regions overnight. Again, the rain is likely to be heavy and persistent at times, and there's an ongoing risk of local flooding. Temperatures overnight will be between 8 and 10 degrees and the winds will be light southerly. Friday will be a wet and breezy day, although it'll start out drier in parts of the east and northeast. Winds will be moderate to fresh south to southwest and temperatures will be down to between 13 and 15 degrees at the very best. Saturday will be another showery day. There'll be some brighter spells between the showers and temperatures will rise to between 15 and 18 degrees in moderate fresh west to northwest winds. And Sunday, although starting out dry at first, will see even more rain to round out a rather wet week. That's the forecast. Good morning.